Good morning. It is time to start our second class of the day. Our class will be led by our brother Jim Stiles of the Livonia, Michigan Ecclesia. Our brother Jim's topic for this week is Ezra, Working Together in Ecclesial Life. And the topic for his first class is God Set Us Free to Work in His Service. Our brother Jim.
Good morning, everyone. I have been assured that everyone had a good caffeine break in between first and second period, and that there should be no head bowing going on, no eyelids coming down. I have been known to call on a few people once in a while. Our studies of Ezra. Ezra is one of those Bible topics that hopefully not too many of you have spent a lot of time studying in the past. I know it tends to get skipped by a lot of the Sunday schools, and so people grow up through our Christadelphian Sunday school system and don't know a whole lot about the period of Ezra, because there isn't time in the Sunday school year to talk about the story of Ezra. So hopefully this week we'll get a chance to look at some of the lessons and a little bit of the background and the times of Ezra, and I think you'll find, as I have, that there are many good ecclesial life lessons, family life lessons coming out of the story of Ezra that we can take home with us by the end of this week and try to implement in our lives and our ecclesias and our families when we leave this Bible school next week. There will be a handout every day, a little half sheet of paper there with some notes on it. And for the sake of those that are listening to CDs and tapes and all that kind of thing, I do offer electronic versions for if any of you that are listening in the future want to email me. You can just contact me at jimstiles10. That's jimstiles10@yahoo.com, and I would be glad to email you a copy of the notes that everyone has here this morning. I listen to a lot of tapes myself and CDs and so on. I find those very, very useful, and so I can always appreciate it when people make available the hard copies of the notes or some version of the notes. That's great. Well, why study Ezra? Ezra is an exciting study for today, brethren and sisters, when you look at some of the things that are going to come up in this story. We are going to be able to experience brothers and sisters working together in ecclesial life through all of their troubles. We'll get a chance to get into the problems that they have and the things that they're experiencing and try and figure out how did they solve them? How did they work through these troubles? And give us some strategies for working on the troubles that we experience ourselves. We're going to find plenty of practical lessons in family life and ecclesial life as we look at the story of Ezra, and we look at the things that these people did in coming back from Babylon and trying to rebuild their community and all the struggles that they went through, problems that they had both within their community and problems that they had at large from the adversaries that came up at that time. You'll find in a study of Ezra that there are tremendous parallels to Christ's soon return to restore and build the everlasting household of God, to God building his house. This story about Ezra isn't just about building a physical temple. It's also about what the angels do in trying to put together the spiritual household of God, an ongoing work that takes place all the time, and one in which finally the final temple of God, his real living stones, will be put together when Christ returns very soon. And we could study Ezra from that perspective, although that is not our goal this week, and looking at the types that are there and all about the things about Christ coming. What I want to do this week is focus in on what did it mean to the people at that time, because I really believe that's where the major ecclesial and family lessons come from. And we certainly can have confidence and peace that grows as we watch the unseen angels working behind the scenes to carry out God's plan. And that will be one of the underlying themes that's there consistently through this week. We will see the angels at work, the angels of God out there doing this and doing that and orchestrating the events and working with the people, trying to control things and organize things to bring these people into God's kingdom so that they will be part of those living stones that will be part of the eternal kingdom that will be set up in the age to come. And you're going to see that over and over again, the unseen work of the angels. And what I find that does for me, brothers and sisters, it gives me tremendous confidence that those same angels are out there working with us today. So for those of you who thought you weren't going to get on the angels study, you see, with the teens, You're going to find out that angels are everywhere in the Bible. It doesn't matter what Bible topic we study. If you're looking for them, they're there. And it's just a matter of being aware of what they're doing. And sometimes it's helpful when somebody can point those things out to us. The angels, I find them all over the place. This should definitely be an exciting story for us, brothers and sisters, as we look through this period of Ezra this week. If you're looking at some of the events that are taking place at this time, if you want to like just set your perspective of where we're at in the study of Ezra, what had happened is that, remember, at the end of the time period of the kings, when Zedekiah was finally taken captive, remember, he saw his family killed at that point. His eyes were put out. He was taken up captive to Babylon, and Zedekiah went up to Babylon. Finally, the end of the captivity took place at that time, where the rest of the captives went up to Babylon. And the Jews were in Babylon for the 70 years, and God had promised he would bring them back. So we are at the period in the story of Ezra where at the end of, really the way our Bible is set up, is that if you read through 2 Chronicles 36, 2 Chronicles 36 ends up on the note of the proclamation of Cyrus, the very same thing that Ezra starts off with. So really what we have is the record of Chronicles, and then right into Ezra and Nehemiah and Esther, we have like a continuous story going on. It just skips the entire 70-year captivity. It just isn't there. And it leaves the prophets for telling us a little bit about, like Daniel, what happened during that 70-year captivity, or Ezekiel. So we get some background into what happened during that point of time. So where we're at right now is that are going to return. Some of these exiles are coming back. There's going to be a bunch of them come back, thousands that come back, with Joshua and Zerubbabel in the first wave of the return in Ezra 1 and 2. Then we're going to find in chapters 3 and 4 that the temple, the rebuilding of the temple, finally begins. And then and later on in chapters 5 and 6 in the week, we'll see how Zechariah and Haggai were trying to motivate the people to finish that work, because they started out on a real high note, and then as time went on, it sort of slacked off, and finally they stopped. And it took these prophets to get them back going again. And then finally, after the temple is finished, in Ezra 7 to 10, we find that Ezra then comes back at that point in time, and he returns with a bunch more exiles to come and actually work in this temple. And if you're looking at the time period of trying to put some of the pieces together, at least a suggestion as to how this works together, is then you find the story of Esther fits in at this point, where God uses Haman to convince the Jews to come back. Because what had happened is God sent out the opportunity through Cyrus to come back to the land. Some of the Jews came back at that time. Then later on, when Ezra comes back, a few more Jews came back at that time. But God could not coax a lot of them to leave Babylon and Persia at that time. They had settled in up in those areas. And so the story of Esther occurs right around this time period to try to convince. Here we got the angels again working out there in the world. And the angels' job had been to convince these Jews to come back to their land. And what better way to do that than the story with Mordecai and Haman and Haman's attempt to destroy the Jews in the kingdom up there. And they realize we better get out. And you'll see that call of getting out of Babylon for those Jews. Nehemiah then returns and comes back and sees that the area is in the shambles and the walls of Jerusalem need to be built. And then finally we end up with Malachi and the time between the Testaments. And that pretty much is this time period that we're looking at in the period of Ezra. One of the questions that always comes up in the story of Ezra is, what do you think? If you were asked to guess ahead of time, if you were trying to make a prediction, how many times do you think Ezra himself appears in the first six chapters? Any ideas? None. A lot of times we don't realize that about the story of Esther, the story of Ezra, that we think that Ezra, the book of Ezra, is all about Ezra himself. But the book is broken up into two major divisions. Chapters 1 to 6 are all about the building up of the temple at this point, the initial return. Ezra stays up in Babylon at this time. He's still up in Persia at this time, because now the Persians have taken over. He's still up there waiting for the temple to be built. And then chapters 7 through 10 actually involve Ezra himself. So what you'll find in this story is that when Ezra wrote the book, and I do believe he's the author of the book, that Ezra had to then gain by compiling things that had happened earlier in his life with things that he actually was a part of later on in chapters 7 to 10. And that may account for why some of the names in the story appear to be a little bit different. Like if you've ever wondered like why Zerubbabel is referred to as Sheshbazzar sometimes and Zerubbabel other times, it may be because of the compiling that went on, where he was counting on other people's records and Ezra actually compiled them together under the inspiration of God. That's just a possibility. So that's actually the way the book is set up. And we're going to look most of this week on chapters 1 to 6. We'll spend probably 4 of the days on those. And then the last couple of days we'll spend on Ezra 7 to 10, where Ezra actually gets involved himself. And Ezra is involved in the work. The purpose of the book of Ezra, when you start looking at, well, what is this book supposed to teach us? Why did God leave this book on record for us today? The purpose of the book. Well, one of the reasons that this book is here is to show that God is faithful. God had promised. He had promised the remnant that he would take some out of the land of Israel and take them up to Babylon and regrow his community in Babylon. And he promised to bring them back. And this story of Ezra, when you look at the book and you see how it unfolds, is going to be a record of the faithfulness of God that he carried out through the angels exactly what he had said he would do. He promised that he would only take them out of the land for that 70-year period, and then he would bring them back and regrow them in the land and unify the kingdom together, and God is faithful. He did accomplish that. And it's certainly when you watch this happening, and you see as we're going to study this week, and you look at the political events that are going on in the kingdom, in Persia at this time, and you look at our current events that are happening today, and in Brother Paul's classes he'll go through with you, you're going to see that in the same way that the angels were orchestrating things back then, and setting up the political conditions so that everything could happen at the right time, it's exactly what the angels are doing today. They're involved the same way, orchestrating the events of our world, putting the political situation right so that they can finally say to God, we're ready for this to happen, and bring about the day of the last trump and the resurrection. And the angels are excited that this is happening. They can't wait for it to occur. Imagine being part of that group of angels that have set all these events together, and they just can't wait to see the final culmination of God's kingdom come to play. And you're going to see this coming about in the story of Ezra as well. They were just as excited back then, looking for joy, waiting for the day in which these exiles would come back, in which finally this temple would be rebuilt. That's the kind of excitement that we're going to see in the faithfulness of God and working through these angels to restore his kingdom. And the second item up there, that God will build his house. Now, that's all part of this story as well in the book of Ezra, that we're going to see that God said he would take care of this. He will get his house built, both the physical house in the story of Ezra, and while the physical house is going up, what the angels are doing is they are building the spiritual house. And it's so true of ecclesial life today. We get involved in projects in ecclesial life, and we get involved in activities in ecclesial life, and we're so focused on the project or the activity that we're trying to do. And what the angels are doing is using those events to work on our characters, as we work with one another, as we deal with people, because their goal isn't the project. Their goal is the people. They want the living stones that are going to be part of that eternal temple that will be put together, and they simply use those projects that we get involved in as the framework for putting together God's spiritual house. And we're also going to find that there is a good, severe warning in the story of Ezra, in this book that we'll study, as well as in Nehemiah, of the problems that can develop in the community of God when mixed marriages become a problem. And so there's a warning in the book of Ezra as this, and there's also a warning in the book of Nehemiah. Both of them end up with the warnings in the end of the problems of mixed marriages when people are marrying folks who are unbelievers, who are not interested at all in God. No interest at all in God. And you'll see that as this goes on. When you look at the reasons for how this all happened, the reasons for the 70-year captivity, why did God send his people out of the land in the first place? God had brought his community into the land through Moses, and Moses had brought them through the wilderness, they'd come up into Israel, and Joshua brought them into the land, and the Jews had been established in Israel for 1,000 years. 1,000 years they'd been in the land and went through the period of the judges and the kings and so on. They got to the point where they thought, there is no way God could remove us from the land. We own the land. Jerusalem is our city. And he couldn't possibly do that. But he did. He sent his angels down, and they carried the people away in waves. They went up to Babylon. You know, and Daniel goes first, and later on, other prophets would go, and Ezekiel would go, and the people, and Jeremiah's left in the land with a few, and in the end, they go on down to Egypt. Why did God have to do that? Why the 70-year captivity? Because that's the background for this story, the book of Ezra. Well, what we find in Ezekiel is that the peoples had taken idol worship. It was so intense in them that God couldn't even get it out of them. He couldn't get it out of their hearts. Jeremiah was constantly, when you study Jeremiah's prophecy, he was warning the people about idolatry, that these people had turned to idols. They had gone and they'd hewed out their own cisterns, as he says, and they were taking their water from another source. You know, can a bride forget her attire? How in the world could God's people forget their God? How could they exchange their God for another God? And Jeremiah is constantly dealing with this issue of idol worship. The people had gone to idol worship, which was all a part of intermixing with the peoples of the land and the idolatry that came with it. So what God did is he said, look, through Jeremiah, this problem is so bad. The only way I'm ever going to break this problem of idolatry is to take these people out of their secured homes where they have all this stuff and take them up to a land where they cannot have it, and then I'll wait a while and bring them back and hope that at that point I can knock idolatry out of these people. And you know, it worked. It really, really worked. Because you think, in the history of Israel, after they came back under the Joshua and Zerubbabel period right now, and they come back to the land, when do we find idolatry being a major problem amongst the Jews again? And you look, go back through the Jewish history, you look through the period of the Maccabees, and you go through the period of time between the Testaments, and you come all the way up to the time of Christ, and it wasn't idolatry, it wasn't that they had the physical idols anymore, that was not the problem, you see. Now what they had done is they had now moved so far away from idolatry, they'd gotten into the Bible. They're going to study that Bible, study that law, and know that law. And now the problem was another extreme that had developed in the community of the legalism of going to the law. And that was an offshoot of this whole period when you start looking at what had happened as the community moved from one extreme to another. But Ezekiel points out that God's problem right now is that these idols were in their hearts. Even up in Babylon, they still had these idols in their hearts. What God wanted to do is he wanted to save a remnant. He had promised Abraham that God would take responsibility for keeping the truth alive and save a remnant through Abraham's line. And he did. And you'll find this in the story of Ezra, that the 70-year captivity accomplished that goal. One of the things that we don't often look at is the fact that God used the 70-year captivity to unite Judah and Israel together. Look at how many years had gone by since Rehoboam and Jeroboam had first divided off the kingdom, and the kingdom had split. And the years it went on between the northern kingdom and the southern kingdom, and they couldn't get along. And the Jehoshaphats would come along, and they'd try to unite the kingdom, and God would say, wait a minute, this isn't the right time. These people are not ready to unite. And they could not work together, and the community was constantly at war, the northern and the southern kingdom. But God predicted through Ezekiel that the day would come when he would take the two sticks and he would put them back together again and make one stick. And it's happening in its first fulfillment in the story of Ezra. Finally, these people are coming back, and after all of the suffering that they had endured, the captivity that they'd gone through, they come back into the land, and finally, you don't hear any more about northern and southern kingdom, and this community is finally united. And you know, the sad exhortation that comes out of that, brethren and sisters, is that that should be our goal today in ecclesial life. Our community should be united. And look at how often we sometimes worry about the little things. We get involved in the little things of ecclesial life and have the discussions and debates and disagreements over the little minor things of life. And we fail to appreciate the importance of unity in ecclesial life. Look at what it took to bring unity at that time. God had to remove his people right out of the land, take them up to another area where they were slaves and captives again, and bring them back down into a land in which they had nothing, in which they were living under the fear of the adversaries that were around them and the peoples of the land. That's what it took for the brethren and sisters back then to be able to look around and appreciate each other and see them for their good. I remember being really impressed when 9/11 happened, a couple of years ago, at watching these people working together. And to me, this was the major lesson that I took out of this from the perspective of a Christadelphian trying to figure out what is God trying to teach us. I watch people who days earlier had been bickering about little things of life, realizing that now we've got to be united. And people in New York were uniting together. Unions that used to fight each other, communities that used to be at war, management and workers, everybody was out there on the lines working together. But look at what it takes to get that accomplished. And sometimes ecclesial life and family life is the same way. The angels are forced because of how we respond to situations and our failure to appreciate one another. They are forced to bring tragedies and troubles into our life to try to get us to appreciate one another, to see the good in one another, and to see the value of working together in ecclesial life and family life instead of worrying about the small things and the things that we have built up to be so big that aren't near as big in the eyes of God. That it will be a powerful lesson as you follow this through this week and realize how God brought these people together to learn to appreciate each other and use adversaries to pull this off even when they came back to the land. And the other reason that we don't mention a whole lot was so that the land could enjoy its Sabbaths. Now, God had made that very clear in Leviticus 26 and 2 Chronicles 36 that the land was supposed to rest. It was God's land, and he demanded that the people give the land its Sabbath rest. And so we might not consider that to be a big issue, but God did, and he mentions it consistently in the prophets that the land will finally get to enjoy its Sabbaths, because when the people did that and they realized that they were taken up into their captivity and they were gone from the land and the land was enjoying its Sabbaths, then they finally took it to heart that it was really God's land. It was his land. It was not their own. And you know that when you were up there in Babylon thinking about what it used to be like and God had removed us from the land. And every so often, God has to remind us, brethren and sisters, that it's his ecclesia. It's not mine. It's his ecclesia. It's his community that we have the privilege of serving in. And every so often, God has to bring events into our life that remind us that it's not my ecclesia. It's not even my family. It's not our community. It's God's community. And we have the privilege of working in that community today. So those are some of the things that we'll look at as to why the 70-year captivity, and we'll see those reasons unfold as the week goes on. When you look at the political situation that was taking place in the land right now, we would have thought it was hopeless for the 70-year captivity to be over. If you had been alive back then and you had been living up in Persia or up in Babylon with Daniel, and you'd be aware of Daniel and his prayer that's going on in Daniel 10 of realizing that the end of the captivity was near and Daniel's praying that it will happen, the political situation back then really did look hopeless for those people. Persia had, at this point, Persia hadn't yet taken over, but if you were in the last years of the times of the kings of Babylon, Nabonidus was the king of Babylon at this time. Remember, his son Belshazzar was the one who pulled out the vessels and used them in Daniel 5. But Nabonidus, who was actually the king of Babylon, he was a very religious man. And what he did is he went around building temples for the gods of the other nations. He was quite involved in going out to other nations. He liked to be involved in the adventures and in leaving the city of Babylon. He'd go out and do a lot of the work. And so he left his son Belshazzar in Babylon and left him to sort of hold down the fort in the city. But what Nabonidus would do is he'd go around and he'd collect gods from all these different nations that he would conquer. And he would bring those gods or some of their things back into Babylon, and he would build little temples for them. And he would think then that what they would do is that he would get these people then to pray for his kingdom. And he sort of thought, well, if he got all these gods together and they were all working for him and they were all praying for him, that maybe some of those gods would have enough power to establish his kingdom and really make it strong. What that did, though, is it left the priests of his religion in Babylon. They were very upset with him. They actually didn't like what he was doing, and they couldn't wait for the day in which Nabonidus was actually pulled out of power. If you remember the kings of Babylon, if you go back in your history and look at what had happened, remember Nebuchadnezzar had some sons and daughters that were involved. Remember evil Merodach was involved after Nebuchadnezzar. And then finally you end up with Nergal-Ezer was in for just a few years. And now we're in this period now where Nabonidus over here is involved. And finally he makes his son Belshazzar a co-regent. So those of you that have this little Bible insert on the chronology of Daniel and his contemporaries, we're right in this period right over in here. And you can see that here's where the fall of Babylon will take place around 539, 540. And finally Zerubbabel and Jeshua will then begin the return. that's about where we are in this period. What happened, though, at this time is that the angels brought about a condition that nobody had expected would occur. Babylon had been in power for years. 50, 60, 70 years had been going by, and Babylon had been actually around 50-some years that they had been in power. It had gone on for a long time where they had controlled the empire. Nobody expected Babylon to fall so fast. But what happened is that the Babylonian priests and some of their people were so upset at what Nabonidus was doing and his policy of collecting all these gods and bringing them back to Babylon, that evidently they worked out something, the Magi there, and in political history, when they go back to study this to try to figure out how is it that Babylon fell in a night? How did this actually happen? Well, it appears as though Cyrus and some of his military people had made a deal with the city, and they were expecting Cyrus to come, and Cyrus came in through the main gates. There's different ways of when people look through history of trying to figure out what actually happened, whether they diverted the waters and they came in under, opened the gates. But the main thing everybody knows from history is that the people generally welcomed the Persians because they were hoping for in Cyrus to get a different kind of leadership than they had found in Nabonidus. When you look at some of the strategies that went on at that time, they were totally different as to how to handle the peoples. The Babylonian strategy was to exile people, whereas the Persians, what they would do is they would leave the people in their lands and they would incorporate them into their existing governments and people. And that's the strategy that they would take. The Babylonians did one thing, well, just like the Assyrians. Remember how the Assyrians, their strategy had been to scatter people all over, and that's where we got the Samaritans from in the land of Israel, because they had brought in all these foreigners. That was a different strategy that they had. The Persians have a different strategy of working with the people and incorporating them into their governments. Now, when you look at the political situation back then, brothers and sisters, you can see it's very similar to our day. We don't see angels walking around today. We don't actually see the angels, but you can feel their presence. Just like the angels were working back then and controlling the political governments, bringing about a total overthrow of Babylon in a night, and the Persians would take over. They would have a totally different strategy of sending the Jews back to the land as opposed to the Babylonian strategy. The angels accomplished all this in a night. In one night, there was an overthrow. And finally, Babylon was thrown down. Babylon the Great had fallen, in a sense. And it's a story that will be relived again in these latter days, as we'll look at this week, I'm sure, in Brother Paul's classes, of Babylon falling, and it will happen just like this. It will happen fast, it will happen in a moment, and the angels will bring it about the same way in our latter day. And, you know, you look at the situation back then, there were no visible angels around. There were no people back in Ezra's time and in the times of Jeshua and Zerubbabel. These people didn't have the spirit gifts, but God was still working in these people, very active, very much alive in their lives, just like he is today. And hopefully we'll get a chance to look at how some of those things worked out in their lives throughout the course of this week. For any of you that have looked into Ezra at all, you may be aware that there's a use of Hebrew and Aramaic in this story. You'll find that both of these actually show up. The Hebrew actually occurs when you're looking at the original text, at least. The original text was written in Hebrew in chapters 1, verse 1, all the way to 4 and verse 7. And then it switches to Aramaic from chapter 4, verse 8, all the way to chapter 6 and verse 18. And then it switches back to Hebrew in chapter 6, verse 19, and stays Hebrew until chapter 7, verse 12, where it switches back to Aramaic. And then in the end, chapter 7, verse 27 to the end, is actually back in the Hebrew again. And again, this lends support to this idea that probably what Ezra was doing was compiling things when he got back to the land, as he may have also compiled the rest of the books of the Bible. We really believe that Ezra was probably the scribe. One of his main missions in life was to put our Bibles together as we have them now today, and that he actually wrote this book, compiled writings that he had gotten from times when he was not there, and he put it all together. Some of the letters that were written may actually be the reason for some of the Aramaic as well, some of the letters that were written at that time, especially the one in chapter 7. But Ezra compiled all these things together and put them together in the form that we currently have today. And we do think it was Ezra, because when you look in the book itself, when you look at the author of the book, it appears as though Ezra was the author, because he refers to the use of I. You'll see words like me and I and so on in chapter 8. And so it certainly appears that Ezra was the writer. And we'll see that as we go on through the week when you get into the later chapters when Ezra actually shows up. When you try to figure out in the time period where we actually are right now, here is a little different timeline, which maybe will help some of you see a bit where we are. Here's the Babylonian kings had been up here at the top. Now we have the Persians. Cyrus is now in control at this time. There may have also been a Darius at that point as well, in terms of like when you look at some of the things that happened in Daniel. But Cyrus is the one who's going to issue this decree to allow the Jews to return. And so really the book of Ezra actually starts right about here when Cyrus issues his decree. And you can see that here's Zerubbabel. We're going to have Jeshua and Zerubbabel involved. The temple is going to be worked on. The temple is actually, they stop for a while, they resume, they finally finish it into the reign of a different king. We're into this king, Darius Hystaspes, that we'll look at. And later on in the week, I'll give you a handout of some of these Persian kings when we actually get to the period that we're going to look at a little bit of the history. But for now, it's just nice to have a bit of a framework as to where we're at. We're starting out, chapter 1, chapter 2, chapter 3 are all during this period right in here. In this period of Cyrus's life right here, and then into his son Cambyses right here, are really about the first four chapters of Ezra. You'll notice that in this diagram right there, if you can see that Cyrus, what we read as the first year of Cyrus when they began, it was not really Cyrus's first year. When you go back and study that, I was surprised when I realized that people kept talking about Cyrus reigning for 20 years. And you tried to fit in all his 20 years, and it just didn't fit. And then they realized, well, really what happened is that Cyrus had taken over leadership of the Persians a long time, actually some 10 years previous to his final time when he walked into Babylon and took over the kingdom. So when our Bible refers in Ezra chapter 1, now if you want to turn there and have a look at the first chapter today, in Ezra chapter 1, when it says, now in the first year of Cyrus, king of Persia, that's actually the first year that Cyrus reigned as king of the world, where he had taken over the Babylonian Empire now, and Cyrus was the sole ruler at that point. That was the first year that he was the sole ruler in Babylon at this point. That's really what the first year of Cyrus is. He actually had started ruling about 10 years earlier, and he reigns for about another 8 years, maybe another 10 years, so the total of his reign is somewhere around 20 years when you look at the total period of Cyrus himself. When you look at Cyrus in the Bible, we don't have a lot of time this week to study a lot of these types that are there, and sometimes that's what Christadelphians spend a little bit more time on. You're probably familiar a bit with how God used Cyrus as a type of Christ, that he had raised up Cyrus. Isaiah had made this very clear in his prophecies in chapter 44 and also in chapter 45 that God had named Cyrus before he was ever born. And Isaiah had predicted of Cyrus that in chapter 44 at verse 28, God calls him my shepherd, and he shall perform all my pleasure, saying to Jerusalem, you shall be built, and to the temple, your foundation shall be laid. And so God used Cyrus, a Persian king that he specifically raised up for his purpose, as an example to the Jewish community and to ourselves today of the Messiah that was to come. He used him as an example of how he can raise up a ruler who will accomplish his will. And in the same way that he raised up Cyrus, his shepherd, or as he calls him in Isaiah 45, thus says the Lord to Cyrus, his anointed, he calls him there, whose right hand I have held to subdue nations before him and loose the armor of kings and open before him the double doors so that the gates will not be shut. He uses Cyrus as a type of Christ, as an example of God's power to raise up a man who will someday issue the decree to proclaim freedom to his people, gather them all back to his land, and build his spiritual house. And that's what he's using Cyrus for. You know, he says in verse 4 that he had named him ahead of time. It was an example to people before the birth of Christ that God will do this. He will accomplish his plan. But the interesting thing to note back here is that God would use a foreign ruler as a type of his son. And that happens in the Bible, where God's trying to impress people with, here's what it's going to be like. And how do you impress people with God's authority and his power to raise up a political ruler who will set you free and open the doors and proclaim freedom to his people, other than to use one of the leaders at that time, one of the political leaders, and say, look, I knew he was coming. I prepared it all ahead of time to set you all free. And in the same way that this man has done this, I am going to bring my son, as Isaiah very clearly points out, only he won't just give you freedom to live now. This son is going to bring freedom forever to the community that he will put together in God's spiritual house. Now, when you're looking at the Cyrus as a type of Christ, I think it's also fun to look at, if you've ever done a study of Esther, any of you that have ever studied the book of Esther, one of the things that comes up in the book of Esther is there's no mention of God in the entire book. There's no mention specifically of God in that book. And yet the story of Esther is full of types about how God will use his son, Mordecai, to bring about the marriage of the bride to the father, to the king of Esther with the king. And while he is doing that, he is going to crush the Amalekite. Finally, his war with Amalek will be over as he defeats Haman and destroys Haman's power, and Haman is left hanging on his gallows. You can't miss that in the story. And yet, as you read through the book of Esther, you sometimes get frustrated. Where's the mention of God? Where's the mention of God? Would God really write a book in which a Persian king, Ahasuerus, was that type of God? And this kind of thing would actually happen. Well, here we have very clearly where Cyrus, a Persian king, is being used as a type of God's son. So it shouldn't surprise us too much when we get to the book of Esther that God was trying to accomplish the same thing of showing his people that he would one day bring about the marriage at that time and destroy the Amalekites forever. And he did that through the use of a Persian king, of using Ahasuerus as a type of God at that time. Jeremiah's prophecies about the 70 years. When we come to Ezra chapter 1, one of the first things that we're told in verse 1 is that now in the first year of Cyrus, king of Persia, that the word of the Lord spoken by the mouth of Jeremiah might be fulfilled. The Lord stirred up the spirit of Cyrus, king of Persia, so that he made a proclamation throughout all his kingdom, and he also put it in writing. Verse 1. Well, you look at Jeremiah's prophecies. Here they are. Jeremiah 25. Jeremiah had said very clearly, or God had said through him, that after the 70 years are over, God promised that he would punish the nation that had taken them captive because of things that they would do later on. And you can certainly see that when Belshazzar just totally misused God's vessels, that's what started it rolling. Jeremiah 29, in verses 10 to 14, God had said that after 70 years, he will promise to bring the Jews back, and he will give them a future with peace and with hope. And you can imagine how they would have hung on those words of Jeremiah throughout the captivity. Confident, the ones who believed, the remnant that was being regrown in the land, that God had promised to bring them back. And when he brings them back, he's going to give them a future and he's going to give them a hope. And that promise in Jeremiah 10, in Jeremiah 29 at verse 10, that promise that God made, that was not conditional upon the people responding. That was one of these unconditional prophecies in the Old Testament. Totally unconditional because God promised it himself, that he would take care of it. And see, those are the kind of things you look for in the scriptures. This is not a case of, well, if you do this, then I will do that. God had promised because this was Abraham's nation, and he had made promises to Abraham. He promised that he would orchestrate the events, that after the 70 years, he'd send his angels out and he'd make sure that the people got back to the land and he would give them an opportunity to have peace and hope and a future in that land after those 70 years were over. And to the ones that believed him, they got to actually live through that, and it was fulfilled in their lifetime when God promised to give them that opportunity of being free. When you look at in verse 1, one of the other things that comes up in verse 1 is that God stirred up the spirit of Cyrus. In Ezra 1 at verse 1, the king of Persia, God stirred up the spirit. Now you can imagine, you know, after studying the angels for a while and thinking about the angels, see, I don't have any trouble understanding how this would have happened. He sent angels out to work in this community at this time. And one of the goals of one of those angels was to stir up Cyrus's spirit and to get Cyrus motivated. Imagine being the angel that had the privilege of doing that and working with this Persian king and convincing this Persian king and putting it into his mind in some way that he was going to send these Jews back and let them know that this was all a part of God's work, that they were going to go back and that he would end up building the temple for Yahweh, their God. So you find that this is the way that God works. He does stir up the spirits of people, and you can see this consistently in the scriptures. Back in Exodus 35, when God first built his tabernacle, his original first little portable tent house, he stirred up the spirits and the hearts of everyone to bring the supplies for that tabernacle. You find in Jeremiah 51 that the Lord had raised up the spirit of the kings of the Medes against Babylon, that he had stirred up their spirits so that he could bring the Medes against Babylon and set up the circumstances which would allow his people to be freed when the Medes and the Persians finally took over. And now in Ezra 1, he stirs up the spirits of Cyrus to make this decree. We find out in Ezra 1 and verse 5 that he stirs up the spirits of the heads of Judah and of Benjamin, the priests and the Levites, to rebuild his house. If you just glance down to verse 5 of this chapter, this is one of the areas where in some of our versions, I think the King James and the New King James that I use, they put in this word with. But really the way it is in the Hebrew is that in verse 5 of Ezra chapter 1 is that then the heads of the fathers' houses of Judah and Benjamin and the priests and the Levites. And it's not with those, it's all those, including, these are the people that he stirred up, the people from Judah and Benjamin, the priests, the Levites, all those whose spirits God had moved arose to go up and build the house of the Lord, which is in Jerusalem. And then we'll find out again later on in the week when we look at the work of Haggai, that Haggai stirred up the spirit of Zerubbabel and Joshua and all the remnant to continue the work on this house. Because for a while there, the work on the house of God had actually come to a halt, and they had quit working. Now, look at what Cyrus says. In Ezra chapter 1, he says that God had established him to build him a house. But you look in verse 3, that who is there among you of all his people? May his God be with him. Now let him go up to Jerusalem, which is in Judah, and build the house of the Lord God of Israel. He is God, which is in Jerusalem. And whoever remains in any place where he sojourns, let the men of his place help him with silver and gold beside the goods of livestock, besides the freewill offerings for the house of God, which is in Jerusalem. Now, I found that interesting when you look at how Cyrus lays this out, of God working through Cyrus, that what the decree allowed the people to do is that some were free to go. Some were much more mobile than others. They could get up right away on a moment's notice. They packed up and they made the long journey and they came down to Israel and they came back to the land. There would be other people, maybe some of the older ones or those who were in some way not freed up to go at this time, but Cyrus realized there would be some that would be left behind. But the exhortation was, well, for those that are left behind, then at least what you can do is get involved. Send the money, send the supplies, encourage the people, get involved. And sometimes in ecclesial life, brethren and sisters, when we end up having projects that we're doing, we sometimes get real excited about our project, and we want everybody to be a part of our project, and we think that they have to like do it our way with us, and everybody's got to be involved. And sometimes we can get into things like maybe we're planning a witnessing activity, or maybe we're involved in CYC, or whatever it might be. We tend to think, well, everybody's got to get involved in this particular project the way I'm involved. And one of the things that you'll find out in this story as we go through the book of Ezra this week is that there are so many things that need to be done. We can't all be doing the exact same thing all the time. We need to learn to appreciate all the different talents that people can bring to ecclesial life and value them, even if they're not doing it exactly the way we might have thought was the project that they should be involved in right now. And so some of the people did return, and they did the hard work of going back and rebuilding, putting together houses, rebuilding the temple, building the altar, and doing all the groundwork for the others. But then that's what they were doing, was laying the groundwork. And some of the others that were back in the land, well, ahead of time, they could send money, they could send food, send encouragement to keep up the work. And then once the temple was put together, another wave comes down of people that are willing to return at that time. And it's so true of ecclesial life, brothers and sisters. We need everybody involved. And we need to learn to appreciate all the different types of service that our brethren and sisters can bring to God's house. And that's one of the major lessons that we want to see this week in this book of Ezra as we're going through this story, is that as people, I need to learn to appreciate, we all need to learn to appreciate the value of every brother and sister in God's house. Everyone here has something to offer when we go home to our ecclesias. Everyone is needed. We're all important vessels that can be a part of ecclesial work. And we need to have the courage to let God stir up our spirit to get involved, as he did with these people. And from the other side, we need to have the flexibility in ecclesial life to value the service of our brethren and sisters, to not just take certain jobs and think, well, these are important and these jobs aren't. We need people out there cleaning the hall. We need people out there doing landscaping. We need people making food at our activities and bringing things. Look at how Bible school functions when all these different jobs are being done behind the scenes by people that are willing to work, and then the Bible school functions and it flows very well. And if all of us can do a little bit better job when we go home next week at appreciating the service that every brother and sister can bring to ecclesial life, then our ecclesias will definitely flow with a lot more love and thankfulness in the Spirit of Christ as we work together towards God's kingdom.